X-29, number 3A.
On the other hand, this same mind of Christ uncovers the basis of spiritualism to be wrong and unreal because it bases itself on hypotheses and human beliefs, mind, because it borrows its strength from mysticism, spirit, because its claim of immortality is merely an assertion, soul, because its mind reading is an interpretation from the standpoint of human beliefs, principle, because it evolves merely its own beliefs, mind, because it is conscious only of its own beliefs and can never be conscious of real facts, truth, all of which makes its so-called wonders no more than manifestations of transitory illusions, love. Third part. After having shown in the second part how we can uncover through the mind of Christ what is real and what is unreal, thought is led to a further step, to the third part, where it is instructed how to annihilate the beliefs of unreality. Through these pages go a strong tone that error must be reduced to its native nothingness, that we have to make nothing of error, that we have to welcome the end of error, that the nothingness of material beliefs will appear, that mortal error will vanish, that matter reaches its mortal zenith in illusion and forever disappears, that the fact concerning error is its nothingness, that all matter will disappear, that sin, sickness, and death give everlasting place to spiritual reality, and so on. But what is it that annihilates the beliefs of spiritualism and materialism? The general answer Mrs. Eddy gives here is an acceptance and a reflection of the spiritual ultimate. This is the tone of spirit and love which pervades this third part in many hues. Mrs. Eddy explains here that the nothingness of material beliefs will appear, for instance, through a final understanding of spirit, through final spiritualization, through a full reflection of spiritual substance, and through reflecting God's own likeness. So if we ask ourselves how we can get rid of the beliefs of unreality, this third part shows that this can be done by accepting the great fact that man is God's own likeness, that man reflects but love's own idea. The material concept will thereby be annihilated. Having seen that only ideas constitute the identities of being, and that only ideas lead to fulfillment, we must logically take the third step and accept our real selfhood as God's own idea. This new step is brought out in the very first sentence of the third part through the momentous statement. The admission to oneself that man is God's own likeness sets man free to master the infinite idea, Science and Health 90, 24-25. The first subject shows that knowing and accepting final reality reduces error to its native nothingness, mind. Mrs. Eddy impresses upon us here that knowing and apprehending what man as God's likeness is leads us to a new heaven and a new earth and annihilates the sense of dualism that man is separate from God. We are invited to forsake dualism in thought. The essence of the second subject is that spiritual selfhood, which is a part of God, denies material selfhood, which is no part of God or man, spirit. To put it another way, the acceptance of spiritual selfhood, which is God's reflection, annihilates the belief in a material selfhood or absorption. The five erroneous postulates which we find under this subject point to the fact that substance is not something apart from God, but that matter is no part of God or man. In the third subject, we see that understanding soul as outside of body silences the serpent's commendation of a limited and finite sense, soul. The moment we accept soul as outside the body, and this moment is always at hand, we annihilate in thought the false concept that man is the offshoot of material sense. It is here that Mrs. Eddy refers to a mortal as being but a burlesque of God's man, a limited sense of immortal man. Soul in body is not man. Understanding that soul is outside the body leads us to the true sense of government, which is depicted in the fourth subject. Here we find that an acknowledgement of the divine principle governs man scientifically, not humanly and personally, principle. Accepting the government of the one God annihilates false government, the government of personal sense, personal ambitions, and personal opinions. If we submit ourselves to God's government, we cannot help but impart an exalting influence. The fifth subject tells us that the motives and aims of spiritual-mindedness are always constructive, life. This constructive sense is illustrated through Jesus' spirituality. Its effect was never to injure or harm, but was always directed to help, support, save, heal, and supply all good. Spiritual living thus annihilates any misuse of mental power. The sixth subject then explains that the more we accept truth, the nearer we come to the end of error. It bluntly states that Christ, truth, brings the end of error together with the disappearance of matter before the supremacy of spirit, truth. When reading these paragraphs, one gets the wonderful feeling that every effort in the right direction, every acknowledgement of final reality, establishes a divine consciousness which breaks up the claims of error. The consciousness of truth annihilates erroneous consciousness. Through all the preceding subjects, I have spoken of accepting final reality. Now, is this acceptance only for a favored few? No, for love is universal and impartial, and the last subject declares that the science of Christianity offers universal salvation through true spirituality, love. Every man can accept the science of Christianity, and every man can accept it fully. But let us remember that this salvation can only be worked out through our acceptance of true spirituality. Our salvation lies in forsaking everything that is material and human. It is spiritualism which tries to use spirit for material gain and material purposes. The science of spirit offers spiritual gain and spiritual recompense. The leading question in this third part is, how can we annihilate the unreal concept of existence and so have only the real one, spirit? The answer to this is the great proposition that we accept and reflect only the spiritual as the final and ultimate reality, spirit and love. Now, how can we do this? By knowing and apprehending the real mind, by accepting our selfhood to be spiritual substance, spirit, by acknowledging that soul is outside the body, soul, by accepting God's government principle, and by having a constructive mentality, life. Such a state of mind forces error to destroy itself and establishes a spiritual consciousness, truth, so that by accepting true spirituality, everyone can work out his own salvation. Love. Comparing the beginning and the end of the chapter, we can easily perceive its message. Its very first statement is that mortal existence is an enigma. And then, step by step, the text clears up the enigma of mortal, material existence. Until at the end, the way lies open for universal salvation. To do this, Mrs. Eddy uses the methods of science. In the first part, she analyzes what constitutes the real identities of being, in contradistinction to what spiritualism calls real. Then in the second part, she teaches how to uncover what is real and what is unreal, making clear that spiritualism can never know the truth of being, whereas Christian Science, which bases itself on the mind of Christ, can. And finally, in the third part, she shows how to annihilate a false sense of existence by accepting the spiritual as the only reality. Let me stress again that the second and third part depict only how to uncover and how to annihilate material beliefs. The actual uncovering and actual annihilation are the themes of later chapters. If you read the last paragraph carefully, you will find that it emphasizes one of the main purposes of this chapter. Mrs. Eddy writes there, "The calm, strong currents of true spirituality, the manifestations of which are health, purity, and self-immolation, must deepen human experience. You see, we now have that higher sense, that the spiritual must deepen human experience. Throughout the first three chapters, there was a strong human element. Prayer dealt with the human longing to know God. Atonement and Eucharist brought the demands of the Christ on the human, and marriage urges us to wed ourselves to a higher humanhood. Urged the human to evangelize. But now, in Christian Science versus spiritualism, we come to a purely scientific outlook, where the human is no part of reality, and where the spiritual, therefore, has to leaven the human until it finally yields to spirituality. So, the spiritual must deepen human experience, until the beliefs of material existence are seen to be a bald imposition." Science and Health, 99, 23-27. In earlier editions of Science and Health, this chapter was entitled Imposition and Demonstration. No wonder. For what Mrs. Eddy really deals with here are the impositions of mortal mind. This chapter has very little to do with the impositions of spiritualists. It deals with the many impositions we all have to tackle, because we all in one way or another believe in dualism, in the mingling of spirit and matter. This chapter shows the scientific method whereby true spirituality lifts us out of the human into the divine. The climax of the chapter is full of this sense. We are told here that the way to learn life is not human but divine, that the human has no demonstrable divine principle, and that Christian Science teaches only that which is spiritual and divine and not human. Science and Health 99:14-15. We get a strong sense of looking beyond the human into the spiritual and of accepting the divine as the real. As for the nature of the spiritual and the operation of the spiritual, these are considered and dealt with in later chapters. Summary of the Word chapters. Now that we have traveled through the first four chapters, let us relax and take in a broad view of them. In my introductory remarks, I briefly mentioned that the textbook is really one great elaboration of the fundamentals of divine metaphysics. Within divine metaphysics, we have, as you know, four main standpoints, which in the Bible are illustrated through the four sides of the holy city, and which in the terminology of Christian Science are called the Word, Christ, Christianity, and Science. Though they are quite distinct from one another, we must never forget that being is one, and that consequently these four must reflect one another. The Word, for instance, not only expresses itself in its own nature, but also reflects the Christ, Christianity, and Science. And this is exactly what the first four chapters illustrate. Let me explain what I mean. As we went through the first four chapters, we were really always approaching God. Our goal was to find an answer to what God is. This is the standpoint of the Word. But in our approach, we saw that we went through four different stages. And what were they? The beginning of our approach to the infinite subject was the chapter prayer, where Mrs. Eddy presents the necessary mental qualities for an ordered approach to God. This is typically the standpoint of the Word in its own aspect, the Word reflecting the Word. Then a further step urges itself upon us in our search for God, the demands of Christ to reconcile our mentality with God in order to be at one mind with Him. Atonement and Eucharist set forth these demands and so depicts the standpoint of the Word reflecting the Christ. As in our search for God, we accept those demands to the best of our understanding, the outcome is an exaltation of everyday life. The tone of Christianity appears because, as you know, Christianity is always the outcome of the Christ idea. At this point, we begin to see that seeking the spiritual involves the demonstration of a higher sense of humanhood. This is a subject in marriage, and the standpoint there is therefore that of the Word reflecting Christianity. Furthermore, as in our approach to God, we follow the urge to give our existence a more and more spiritual tone in order to make happiness, affections, and companionship more lasting, more enduring, and more constant. We naturally long for a final answer to what mortal existence is and what actually is real. Thus we come to the chapter, Christian Science versus Spiritualism, which gives an explanation of what is real and what is unreal, declaring spirit to be the real and the only. Science is that which explains. Hence the standpoint here is that of the Word reflecting science. And writing from this standpoint, Mrs. Eddy makes absolute, definite statements that only the spiritual and the divine are real, and that the mortal, the material, the human, and the moral are no factors whatever in the science of spirit. Animal magnetism unmasked. To admit that spirit is the only and the real, and that we must go beyond the human into the divine, is in itself insufficient, however. A further step must be taken, which is vitally important. Why? Because there is a claim that not only the divine and good, but also the human, animal, and evil have operative power and exercise their influence upon mankind and the universe. Mrs. Eddy, therefore, reaches the point where she has to investigate and state the operative power of the divine and good, which we call the Christ power, and uncover the powerlessness of evil, or animal magnetism, the Antichrist. Thus, the student is led quite naturally to a change of standpoint, that of the Christ. The next four chapters are all written from the Christ standpoint. Let me explain this change of standpoint also in another way. Throughout the first four chapters, the student is seeking God, approaching God, reaching out for the infinite, trying to grasp reality. The trend is from man to God, as it were. But then, thought asks, what do I find if I seek? How does this vision affect me? How does this vision influence me? What power does this vision exercise upon me? What change does it affect in me? Hence, the trend changes to the opposite direction, the direction of God to man, of what comes to us. The human mind makes us believe that good and evil come to us. The good that comes to us is the Christ, the divine message from God to men. Science and Health 332:10. Whereas the evil that claims to come to us is the Antichrist. The Christ illustrates how God reveals himself to us, translates himself to us, how God comes to us and changes us, and how he manifests himself to us. The Antichrist claims that apart from God, good, there is another power called evil, and that evil also comes to us, revealing and translating itself to us, and manifesting itself in us. So the student quite logically wants to know what this so-called Antichrist is, and demands an investigation into the subject of the Antichrist, or animal magnetism. Only when he sees clearly that evil is not a power, is not real, and cannot come to him, is he ready to accept the infinite good that comes to him constantly. So Mrs. Eddy has first to clear up the question of animal magnetism, which she does in her chapter, Animal Magnetism Unmasked. We left Christian Science versus Spiritualism with the wonderful sense that the calm, strong currents of true spirituality must deepen human experience. The reader may ask at this juncture, what then are those opposite, agitated, uncalm currents of evil or mortal mind which constantly try to disturb human experience? What then is this other so-called current, the animal magnetic fluid? What is this evil influence which seems to come to us from outside? These are questions which need to be answered. You know from your own experience that the declaration alone that spirit is real and the only, though scientifically correct, does not satisfy the student. He immediately counters with a yes, but He may say, if spirit is all, why doesn't evil leave me alone? Why is it that I suddenly feel sick, meet with an accident, feel dissatisfied or depressed without even having suspected or expected evil? Such a student needs a proper insight into the nature and operation of evil called animal magnetism. To unmask the false, aggressive nature and influence of evil is the purpose of this chapter, Animal Magnetism Unmasked. The chapter has a very clear-cut layout. The first subject states that animal magnetism is based on the power of imagination, mind. Here we find an explanation of the cause and origin of animal magnetism. Its so-called force is described as a belief in the influence of celestial bodies, as the excitement of the imagination, or the power of imagination. Its effects are but those of illusion, or of one's faith in esoteric magic. So animal magnetism is here disclosed as a counterfeit of the mind of Christ, as a false influence originating in human beliefs, in illusion, in imagination, in esoteric magic, or similar occult beliefs. Then the second subject shows that animal magnetism is unreal, is a mere negation, spirit. As we have seen that animal magnetism does not originate in the divine mind, but in human imagination, it follows quite naturally that that is not real, and is therefore that which negates reality. So everything in our mentality, in our thinking, which negates God, is animal magnetism. Do not always look for animal magnetism as coming from other people. It comes mostly from ourselves when we negate God, good, our true selfhood, and the infinite possibilities which are always at hand. My epitome for the third subject is that animal magnetism is sin, soul. Mrs. Eddy enumerates some of the main traits through which animal magnetism claims to work. Its sinful nature is indicated by aggressiveness, criminal instincts, subtlety, secrecy, despotism, and the like. It stands in opposition to the benedictory influence of the freedom, the joy, and the bliss of soul. In the fourth subject, Mrs. Eddy explains that all classifications of animal magnetism are erroneous. Principle. What is brought out here is that evil is one, that we cannot therefore classify animal magnetism into, say, better animal magnetism or worse animal magnetism, that all kinds of animal magnetism, whether malicious, benevolent, ignorant, or sympathetic, are just animal magnetism. The genus of evil is evil, and so whatever issues from animal magnetism is animal magnetism and works nothing but evil. Of course, it counterfeits the divine principle which always works out the maximum of good. Let us know, therefore, that only good can come to us. This brings us to the fifth subject, to the fact that animal magnetism is harmful, life. The purpose of animal magnetism is to persecute, to belie, and finally to kill. Sometimes we think that a little bit of error will not matter very much, that it will not have any harmful influence. But it does matter. Its final purpose, its innate nature, is to kill. It is certainly not by chance that Mrs. Eddy, when referring to mortal mind in this paragraph, put mortal in italics. The counterfact to this claim is that life always comes to us as a vitalizing, constructive, resuscitating, and invigorating power. The sixth subject declares that animal magnetism is always wrong and unjust and cannot be justified in any way. Truth. In this subject, Mrs. Eddy confronts the theodicy of Christian Science with the theodicy of scholastic theology. According to Leibniz, ordinary theodicy is to prove that the world as it is the best possible world, and the existence of evil is a necessary condition of the existence of the greatest moral good. In other words, the theodicy of the churches tries to justify evil by teaching that the existence of evil can be reconciled with the faith that God is good. It believes that God is good and yet believes that God uses evil and even needs evil for the purpose of good. When we speak of a necessary evil, we utter a degree of this belief. The theodicy of Christian Science does not justify evil in any way whatever. It rests on the rightness of all divine action and condemns all wrong action as animal magnetism, which it classifies as nothing. This brings us to the seventh and last subject, in which we find the conclusive statement that Christian Science does not sanction animal magnetism, love,